Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations. It was August of 2013. It was Shark Week. And millions of people were glued to their television sets for the viewing frenzy that the Discovery Network uses to lure shark-loving chums together. But this time, according to their special, Megalodon, the Monster Shark Lives, there was something new in the water. Or rather, something old, something ancient, and enormous.
Following the incident, a search and recovery effort was launched. Initially, it was believed that the only creature large enough to down the fishing vessel would be a whale breaching over the top of the boat. But the wreckage suggested otherwise. What the South African officials discovered was unexpected. Officials had brought in an expert to determine what could have killed the people on that boat.
I'm a marine biologist with a focus on sharks. I often get called in when strange events have happened in the ocean, even when that event's very hard to describe. The long story short of it is, I'm usually the first guy to get called when something strange is happening out in the seas. The impact of the vessel is massive. It's much more substantial than I thought it would be. You see, whales, in the rare instances they have collided with boats, end up reaching on top of the boat. But it's clear the vessel was rammed from underneath.
So this wasn't a whale?
No, absolutely not. Sounds to me like whatever did attack their boat did so intentionally, which is further evidence this was no whale. And when the audio is cleaned up, what you hear is chilling.
Could it have been a great white?
Not your typical great white, no.
Then what is it?
I think that whatever did this is a very large predator, maybe even larger than anything we've ever seen in our lifetime before.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
There's a new summer movie coming out soon called The Meg, and it's based on a novel by Steve Alton. I enjoy monster movies, and the film looks like a lot of fun, but it reminded me of this 2013 fiasco of the fake Megalodon documentary. Or I guess that would be mockumentary if so many people hadn't been fooled into believing it was real. There was a large outcry from the science community about the misinformation, but Discovery followed it with a 2014 production called Megalodon: The New Evidence. Discovery continued to add their fake content by producing a documentary about an anaconda eating a human alive, but thankfully, that didn't actually happen on the show. There's a long history of giant snake legends along these lines. You can go back to episode 103 with John Murphy for more about that topic. But in January 2015... Discovery promised it was done with these fakeumentaries. Though if you're going to pretend some extinct animal is real, I can certainly see the appeal of hyping Megalodon for Shark Week. This animal had approximately 40,000 pounds of bite force, which is significantly stronger than the estimated bite force of a Tyrannosaurus rex, for example. It had more than 260 teeth arranged in five rows, replacing damaged teeth throughout its life with huge, sharp, fresh ones. It could bite a small whale in half with one go. And not only was its bite force stronger than T-Rex, but it was also stronger than that of Mosasaurus, the giant Mesozoic marine reptile made famous by Jurassic World. Megalodon's swim speed has been estimated to be twice that of a great white shark. And did we mention it's big? It could reach lengths of over 60 feet, making it so large that even a baby Megalodon was as big as a modern great white shark. In short, Megalodon was an astonishingly efficient killing machine, and there is nothing alive like it today, including Megalodon. So, We can say with a lot of confidence that megalodons are extinct. And while the deep ocean may hide many exciting and creepy animals in its dark depths, there's basically no chance that one of those is a relict population of megalodon. Yet, I've no problem with an obviously fictional movie about these amazing animals. More than that, speaking for Team Smith, we're looking forward to this new movie, The Meg. But what I do have a problem with is these fake humanities like Megalodon, The Monster Shark Lives, or the two mermaid movies presented on a station that girds itself in the smock of science, but instead makes a mockery of it and confuses the public, which is already besieged by nonsense. Will the Discovery Network stay true to its stated goal of avoiding fake content? Well, its child company, Animal Planet, just closed out Finding Bigfoot with its 100th episode. So I guess the gold rush of reality TV was still going on for a bit. Hey, at least they didn't do a crossover with Naked and Afraid. Though I'm sure that the nude Bigfoot hunters out there would be delighted to see their subculture catching more sunlight.
Monster Dog.
I am Dr. Craig McLean. I'm currently the executive director of Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, which is a marine lab on the Gulf of Mexico coast. I am also a deep sea biologist and have spent probably the better part of a couple of decades exploring the deep oceans. A lot of the research in my lab also focuses on the body size of marine animals and why they get to be the size that they are, how their body size differs between oceans or in different regions of the oceans.
We asked you on because really, honestly, since we started this show about 10 years ago, we've talked about a lot of different monsters, and we try to use monsters as a springboard to talk about science topics. And there's a recurring idea that maybe this giant shark megalodon is still out there. And now, we're very skeptical of that for a lot of reasons. We want to talk a little bit about that. But when we were trying to find a megalodon expert, it's such an interesting mix of paleontology and current shark science. We didn't really know who to contact, and your name came up after you contributed to some articles about this topic. So, but yeah, how did you get involved with sharks, though? How did you get interested in sharks in particular?
I have a really perhaps unhealthy obsession with the size of things, like roadside attractions. You know, like the world's largest ball of yarn. If you look at my Instagram account, there's currently I've been doing a series for a while called Craig with Big Things. And it's like, you know. You know, massive rocking chairs or, you know, 40-foot tall fire hydrant statues. I don't know. It's just like I remember growing up as a kid, like my mother had one of those like tiny skating rinks or skating ponds of figurines and stuff like that that would go underneath a Christmas tree. And I was like really fascinated by these like little miniature people for some reason. And so I don't know. Somehow I've managed to turn this into a job.
Nice.
This will actually pay me for. So my PhD was actually working on why, you know, contrary to popular belief, a lot of people believe that most deep sea animals are large, like the giant squid or the giant isopod. But in actuality, a lot of deep sea animals are miniaturized versions of what they would be in shallow water. So you could take, you know, most snails like along the coast or, you know, the ones you would find on the beach, or it could be, you know, anywhere from the size of your thumb to, you know, at the larger size of the size of your fist. But in the deep oceans, most of them, you know, are often microscopic. And so one of the things I did for my PhD was outside of measuring 12,000 tiny deep sea snails is to try to figure out why they were so small. And then since then my lab and students with me have tackled a whole variety of, you know, what do we know about the actual sizes of animals? You know, so how big does a whale shark get to why do whale sharks get so big? And that's sort of, I mean, you know, and so I've had a couple of students who've worked on megalodon, you know, looking at megalodon patterns through time of how big or did they shrink or increase in size through time. And so I don't know, some of it is academic interest and some of it is just pure interest myself. And I've sort of become the go-to for a lot of people on, you know, like, oh, you know, who would know about this body size, it'd be Craig. And so I have the tendency to people sort of bring these kinds of things to me.
No, you can't tease us like that, though. Why were the snails so small? Was it sexual selection, or what was actually?
No, it's, well, some of it is like food limitation, but you know, there's less food in the deep oceans because the lack of sunlight precludes photosynthesis. So you don't get like a base of a food chain. So everything in the deep ocean, for the most part, relies upon the sinking of, you know, carbon in the form of, you know, dead organisms and feces and a whole variety of other fun things into the deep sea. And it actually sort of falls on the deep sea floor like snow, a very light snow.
Wow.
And so that's what most animals exist on, but it's not a very much, and it's pretty poor quality by the time that it gets there. And so that actually leads to this sort of reduction in size, but it's actually a little bit more complicated than that. You have snails that are small in shallow water actually get bigger in the deep ocean, and big snails in shallow water actually get smaller in the deep ocean. So there's like this convergence on this kind of medium Goldilocks size. And the reason we think that is because if you're a big snail, it's hard to survive in the deep sea because you don't, there's just simply not enough food to support your size. But if you're a small snail, it's actually also pretty hard because if you're a small snail, you can't search a very big area for food. And so there's some selection to be this kind of medium size. And then likewise, you know, the more fat you can store, i.e. the bigger you are, the more fat reserves you have and the better starvation resistance you have. So if you're a small snail, not only do you not have a very big, you can't search a very big area for food, but you can't even store food very well. And so it kind of selects for this kind of medium perfect size.
That's neat. We had on Stephen Jones a few years ago to talk about hybrids, and he talked about the sort of brutal sex life of slugs with their hermaphrodite sexual selection, and it was. So I've just been fascinated by snails and slugs since that conversation. It's been really interesting. But I guess we should move on to megalodons.
Well, that's the thing. Craig's saying he's got a fascination with big things. They don't get any bigger than the megalodon, do they?
No, I mean, megalodon definitely is the biggest of sharks. The maximum length we think they got is probably about 59 feet or around 18 meters. I mean, whale sharks can get up to that size, almost. They're peaking out at about the same size. But in terms of an actual flesh-eating shark, you can't get much bigger than megalodon.
So can you tell us a little bit about it? So what did it eat? Where was it found? Just some basic info on it.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it was definitely a carnivore, much like a great whites are. So, there are some fossils. It's hard to sort of know exactly what megalodon ate, and we sort of infer it a bit, knowing what sort of modern sharks eat. But there are a few fossils of whale bones that have megalodon tooth slashes and bites in them. So that would have seemed to suggest that they were trying to take, whales and prey potentially even bigger than themselves. In terms of where they were found, they had a pretty sort of global distribution across the planet. One of the interesting things about megalodon is probably counter to belief, they are not like these monsters lurking in the deepest, coldest parts of the ocean. They actually occurred in sort of warm tropical settings.
Yeah, this was, correct me if I'm wrong on the dates, but 20 million years ago, something like that?
The last known teeth, I believe, are known from about 2.6 million years ago.
Okay.
But we have teeth dating from about 23 to 2.6 million years ago.
But the world was quite different then, not just in climate, but the continents have moved around quite a bit, or have moved since then. So
considerably. But, you know, these guys were sort of big tropical sharks.
Yeah. And when we say big, I mean, what my little bit of reading is that even the babies were bigger than great whites. Is that, I mean, obviously they would have been smaller at some point, but.
I mean, even the juveniles of megalodon were likely to be, about the size of a great white.
That's amazing. So, how do we know they're extinct? I guess let's start with that.
Well, there's sort of several different lines of evidence. I mean, one, so let's talk about how we know about Megalodon in the first place. Well, the primary way we know about Megalodon is from teeth. You know, we have lots and lots of Megalodon teeth, again, from this period of time from about 23 million to about 2.6 million years ago. And then after that, zip, no Megalodon teeth after about 2.6 million years. So from that time to this time, there's no Megalodon teeth. And what you need to know about sharks is that they repeatedly shed and replace their teeth. And so, I mean, if you go out to the shore and sort of go beachcombing, you can often find shark teeth of the sharks that are off of the coast. But there's nothing there. And the other ways we know about Megalodons through, fossilized poo that we think came from Megalodon. And there's a few sort of vertebra columns. And like I said, the whale bones that we have that likely have Megalodon tooth slashes in them, there's none of those sort of things exists after 2.6 million years. We don't have any positive evidence that there's them not only in the fossil record after or before, more recent than 2.6 million years, but you don't go to the beach now and find modern Megalodon teeth just kind of washing ashore, which there would be. That's one reason.
Yeah.
Of course, I think the other reason is they occurred everywhere. Like they had a global sort of tropical distribution. They occurred in shallow water. We would have seen them by now. I mean, when we discover new species, you know, which happens all the time, we discover them because, you know, probably one or, you know, a handful of different reasons. One is that they only occur in a single sort of very specific place that's rare, or maybe they occur, but there's only a few of them left, or a few of them, in the world, or they exist in sort of some unexplored area, or some sort of combination of those three. You know, if you take like the Yeti crab, for example, they only occur at hydrothermal vents, and all of the hydrothermal vents haven't been completely explored. So, which is why we didn't know about Yeti crabs until about a decade ago. Or the coelacanth only occurs in a few specific localities off of South Africa and Indonesia, and it's in deep caves, which are rarely explored. So the fact that we didn't know about coelacanths for a very long time, you know, but megalodons aren't, you know, they're not elusive. They probably weren't elusive. I mean, they were these massive bust-sized sharks swimming around in tropical shallow water. And as much as a commercial fishing operations occur globally, you know, one of them would have been caught in a net by now.
I have to say, you're hitting like every cryptozoology drinking game here. We've hit the Yeti with the Yeti crab, and we've hit the giant squid and the coelacanth. This is awesome.
I'm trying to hit all the, I don't know if you have
who's who with cryptids.
I'm trying to hit them all.
That's awesome.
So speaking of the teeth, how big were its teeth?
The biggest, I mean, you know, I could give you centimeters or sort of that sort of thing to tell. But I think the best way to visualize them is probably about the size of a dinner plate.
Oh, God. That's frightening.
Yes. Yeah, quite substantial.
And then they had dozens of teeth?
Yeah. More than
different
one.
Sets of teeth, yeah.
I've seen that famous recreation of the Megalodon jaw with the guy sitting in it from the early 1900s. And one of my friends has a Megalodon, he has actually a shark tooth display, and his top row is a nice little set of Megalodon teeth, and they're stunning.
Imagine finding one of those on the beach.
Yeah. They're just beautiful.
Yeah, there's quite a few places, like, you know, there's a couple of nice sites in North Carolina in the U.S. where you can go find Megalodon teeth. I mean, it's not hard to find them if you were willing to put in a little bit of the effort.
Yeah, I think that's where he got his, was in one of the Carolinas, so I assume that's the same place. Yeah. So quickly, though, why do sharks shed their teeth? I mean, that's such a strange thing to me, you know, as a terrestrial. So
so they don't have to brush them regularly.
Oh, perfect.
It's a kind of a really nice adaptation for them. They're predators, and so they're a little bit thinner than ours, and they rely upon them having sharp points. I mean, that's a fundamental part of a shark tooth, right, is that it's sharp or serrated in many cases. And so you know, those get worn down over time. And so having them consistently replaced so that they're always able, you can imagine if you had a bunch of dull teeth in your mouth and you're coming up on a fish or a sea lion or something like that, and you can't get a good grip on it, you know, that's not ideal. So having the system in which they're constantly replenished and always sharp and ready to go is kind of nature's answer.
I wanted to know, we've talked about where they lived and, you know, how big they got. One of the questions that we found, like we were talking about plesiosaurs, was I didn't know that plesiosaurs gave life birth. They didn't crawl on the shore and lay eggs. I thought that was interesting. But I know sharks, some do give life birth and some lay eggs. Do we know what Megalodon did in that regards?
That's a great question. I don't know. I mean, that's a, you know, actually, I don't know. And I mean, I think you're sort of hitting my limits of my, you no know, problem. I mean, yeah. I think it should clarify maybe that I'm not a shark biologist.
That's okay. Well, one of the things is I know that you in order to know the answer, you need some kind of evidence to either some eggs or a body with some fossilized, you know, sharks inside.
Right.
But, you know, so I that may not even exist. So it may just be still a question, too. So,
you know, it wasn't until recently that we realized that whale shark can give live birth. Now, I don't know if you've seen baby whale sharks, basically, but they're cute and adorable in the way that you think a baby whale shark might be. And so, I'm not actually for sure with, you know, I mean, I think we could probably infer from great whites that's probably live birth. But, I'm not sure if we actually know or not, or how we would know.
Monster Dog.
As a little editorial note, I did some research after this interview and couldn't find any definitive answer to the question of whether Megalodon was oviparous and laid eggs, or viviparous and gave live birth. The huge shark's similarity to great whites, which are viviparous, inclined some people to believe that megalodons did the same. But until we find a fossil with baby shark embryos in the mother's body, or we find a clutch of eggs fossilized outside of a mother's body, or some other definitive proof of one answer or the other, the question's still out there waiting to be answered. Scientists have found fossil evidence of shark nurseries, so we do know that they had areas designated for rearing pups. But there's much yet to be discovered about these giant monsters of the past, and I look forward to more discoveries about this amazing animal.
Monster Talk.
Yeah. Speaking of whale sharks, another Monster Talk callback. At the Atlanta Aquarium, we have a whale shark. And one of our guests that we've had on the show was a guy named Chet Van Duzer, who did a book about sea monsters on ancient maps. And I got to see him give a talk at the Atlanta Aquarium. So while he's talking, behind him, through a glass aquarium wall, is a whale shark swimming around. It was just an amazing way to see a talk about sea monsters and monsters. It was great.
Yeah.
Al Dove, who is the director of conservation and research at the Georgia Aquarium, spends a lot of his time, you know, researching whale shark, especially whale shark aggregations in the wild. And so, for a few years in a row, we were collaborating on. There's an aggregation of whale sharks off of Cancun, we're talking like a few hundred within a few miles squared. It's very impressive. And they're all over the place. You can sort of get in and snorkel with them. And so one of the things we were trying to figure out is like, well, how do we get accurate estimates of whale sharks in the wild? You know, it's not like you can swim up to them and have them hold still while you pull out a tape measure. And so we worked for a couple of years in a row to try to come up with a really good method. And basically the way that it works is what you can do is you actually can take, because even when you're underwater, you can't take a photograph with a whole whale shark in it and be close enough to be able to sort of identify the whale shark.
Wow.
A standard sort of photo you take of a whale shark is of its side right behind the last gill and right in front of the dorsal fin in that region, because the spot patterns on the side of a whale shark you can actually use to identify individuals like fingerprints. And so what we figured out is you could actually shine a couple of laser dots that are mounted to the sides of a camera onto the side of the whale shark. And if you know what the distance between those two laser dots are, then you sort of can standardize everything to those two laser dots.
You know, I have one simple request. and that is to have sharks with frickin' laser beams attached to their heads.
From a couple of studies and from a bunch of measurements taken on the whale sharks in the Georgia Aquarium, you know, we figured out that distance between the last gill and the dorsal fin, if you take that as a linear measurement, that actually scales pretty well with the entire length of the shark. So we have like this really nice equation in which we can just take a single picture and then scale up to try to get an estimate of how long the shark actually is. And I mean, that's kind of some of the way how we know Megalodon is. So we know, oh, well, we have a mathematical relationship that sort of predicts how big a great white is based on its tooth size. And so if we assume that that relationship also holds for Megalodon, then that's where we get these sort of estimates of length of, you know, near 60 feet, you know, as an upper max.
That's incredible. But is there still debate over how big it could be, or it's pretty much accepted that that's the
There's always going to be debate because, you know, we'll never be able to measure the total length of a megalodon, you know, unless we find a whole megalodon fossil, which would be spectacular. But, you know, we'll never know exactly how much, you know, maybe the relationship between the size of the tooth in other sharks, including the great white, with their total length is not the same relationship it would be for megalodon. And so we're kind of taking our best guess at it.
This is funny. This is kind of the same problem they have with another famous cryptozoology topic, which is Gigantopithecus, which is basically only known from its teeth and one jaw. And it's it looks like an orangutan, so they kind of extrapolate based on the size that it's probably the same. But again, same problem. Without a skeleton, how can you really know? You know, it's probably right. But it's difficult to say, and we have to,
We're in the ballpark, you know. I mean, I think if the relationship is fundamentally wrong, then Megalodon becomes interesting, not because of its size, but because it's a small shark with massive teeth.
Yeah, a bit cartoonish, right?
Yeah.
Interesting visual.
Definition of a shark.
So what about Megalodon itself? Did it have any known predators?
To be honest with you, I don't think we really know. I mean, you can envision, you know, I mean, this could be very typical of these large animals, you know, they don't get preyed upon when they're full size, but as juveniles, you know, everything attacks them in the ocean.
Right, right. But they're so big, it seems like the old, what did they eat? Whatever they wanted. Where do they live? Wherever they wanted, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you think of like, like whale sharks, there's not many predators on whale sharks, when they're in the couple of foot range, you know, in terms of their total length, then everything's a predator to them. So, you know, there's this famous, although geeky joke among, people who study squids about, you know, the common sort of market squid, Lalago, which is what you make calamari on. It, you know, gets to be about a foot in length or so. And it's like, do you know what eats, you know, Lalago? And it's like, well, everything does, you know, birds, turtles, fish, you know, it's bad to be a squid about a foot in length, which is why you have the giant squid that's not a foot in length.
Right.
So do we have any idea how long they lived?
No, I don't think we do. I mean, again, it's the same sort of, we can play these math games. So for most animals that are currently alive, you know, and that are well studied, we have these relationships between body size and things like their growth rate, their lifespan, even their density on the planet, a whole variety of things that you can do. And those relationships, these equations that we use to predict based on the size of animal, the other things that they do, you know, they vary from group to group. So there's, you know, one line for maybe mammals, and it could be even that there's one for carnivores versus herbivores within the mammals, you know, and there's another one for birds and for flightless and, you know, as well as migrating and non-migrating birds. And so we can use those to kind of infer. And I mean, we could probably predict based on the size of Megalodon, how old it gets based on what we know about other sharks, but you're kind of doing the double estimate thing. We're predicting from the tooth, from tooth size, what the upper limit, what the length is, and then for taking that length and making another estimate about how long it lived.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, and every time you do that, you introduce a little bit of extra air into the calculation.
Fair enough.
I know this isn't your area of expertise, but I was curious about the oxygen requirements. I know that modern sharks, or at least some of the sharks, have to swim all the time because of the way their gills are put together. And I was curious, if, like, a shark that big, would it have an issue with the oxygen levels in the oceans today, even if, you know, if it had survived? I wonder.
That's a really good question. I mean, you know, it's, I mean, anything of that size has a huge oxygen requirement. You know, I mean, of course, the oxygen requirement of a shark is not as great as it would be if you were a mammal of the same size. But yeah, they, you know, it could be that they would be running up against hard limits on the oxygen that was available in the water to them.
It's interesting to me, all the climate science, and they have these really interesting ways of finding out how the oxygen levels and carbon dioxide levels changed over time through various deposits, whether it's ice or stone or, you know, just various ways they can tell. I just find that so interesting, you know, how you can push these data points out of various accretions or other records. So,
you know, oxygen and food are two of the strongest drivers of body size. You know, in terms of things in the environment, you know, so we know, like, you know, there's one point, you know, you had dragonflies, you know, when oxygen concentrations in the atmosphere were higher, you had these dragonflies, you know, the size of, I keep coming back to the size of a dinner plate, but it's a useful description.
Yeah, yeah.
Massive dragonflies and other massive insects.
Oh, I know. It's fabulous. I've actually tried to find someone who wanted to talk about giant insects, and it's been difficult to track down the right person. But that is a topic I love, because any museum where they have giant insect models, it's just like, oh, my God, I would love to have been there. And yet I wouldn't. I wouldn't.
I think you think that until, you know, you have like a 2-foot wingspan dragonfly
right
buzzing in your face.
I just want one of those little rolling balls like in Jurassic World, right? So.
you live in Georgia. You should know better than to want bigger insects.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do we know what caused the extinction of megalodons?
Well, no. I think there's a lot of really good debate on this. One hypothesis is that the oceans got too cold for Megalodon. It could be availability of prey items. In fact, I think those are sort of the two running ones, is that the oceans weren't essentially producing enough of a food base for a massive size carnivore like a Megalodon. Mm-hmm. Of the running hypothesis, I think the other strongest one is that it just simply got too warm for them. Because if you think about a warming, you know, and this goes back to this sort of oxygen idea, one of the big things is that when you warm up, so one of the things that you have to worry about with a warming ocean is that, you know, that increases metabolism of animals. And so if Megalodon is already at kind of a hard limit in terms of its oxygen need out of the ocean, and then you, for the same size Megalodon, you increase the temperature so the metabolism goes up. You know, this feeds into this idea that you have that, like, oh, if they're oxygen limited, then that's where this temperature aspect comes in, is that it just increases their metabolism, which of course then, you know, makes it harder for them to find enough oxygen to support that. But also, you know, that requires an energy source in terms of carbon, so they have to produce more food. So this temperature sort of food debate may not be one or the other. It may be both. It's sort of a double hit on Megalodon.
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of interdependency in any of these ecosystems that's really difficult to tell exactly what happened. But we know they disappeared.
Do we, though?
Well, that's
question.
According to the Discovery Channel.
Oh, no.
Well, we actually, one of the reasons I think a lot of our listeners wanted to talk about this was because of this strange documentary slash mockumentary that came on the Discovery Channel about Megalodon being a potentially real animal that's still alive. And so did you hear about that, or did you watch that? Oh, yeah.
So both the I think the two worst things that have happened to marine biology are Discovery Channel sort of mockumentaries on the Megalodon proposing that it could still be around, or that mermaids might still exist.
Another favorite of ours.
Which, of course, or mermaids exist at all, which are both, of course, ridiculous. And we've spent, both a lot of time, not just I, but other marine biologists and scientists and biologists in general, have spent a lot of time online, whether it be on our blogs like Deep Sea News or, Dr. David Schiffman's Southern Fried Science, or with Dr. Andrew Thaler, spent a lot of time sort of combating these kinds of beliefs, and trying to point out, of course, that, both of those had disclaimers that, that they were not real documentaries. The quote unquote video of Megalodon was actually a sleeper shark in the Discovery Channel video. So, yeah. Yeah, it was like before none of those, in my entire career, until those two shows came out, no one had ever once asked me if Megalodon still existed or mermaids were like a real thing. And then after that, that still now, even though it's been a few years, still seems to circle its ugly head.
You were saying a little while ago that if they still existed, that we would have seen them again by now. But it seems like there have been some sightings of the Megalodon. Have you heard of any claims of people believing they've seen it?
I haven't heard. Well, there may be claims.
Yeah, we get a lot of that.
It's almost... with almost certainty, I can say that they've not seen Megalodon.
Yeah, I think they covered this on Monster Quest a while back. That would have been like 2008 or 2009. And they a lot of the sightings were apparently people seeing whale sharks and just not knowing what they were seeing.
Sure. There's other big sharks in the ocean, and some of them even wash ashore. Some of them are, a whale shark, obviously, Greenland sharks, great whites. There's plenty of large sharks in the ocean that we don't have to sort of believe in the existence of the continued existence of a prehistoric shark to have cool sharks in our ocean.
And a lot of the mermaid sightings were actually sirens. And no. It's a common mistake.
I think someone... someone purported a theory to me a few years ago that was that probably most mermaid sightings were based on the dried carcasses of fish, like half-eaten fish or dried up stingrays and things along that line that take a kind of weird human form, as opposed to, anything that might be more believable.
Yeah, they make those dried ones with Jenny Hanover's, where they dry out the rays and cut them to look like faces, and of course there's the P.T. Barnum style Fiji mermaid, gaffs. There's a lot. People have alleged that manatees were behind the mermaids.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think we joke a lot about how I don't know how long you have to be at sea before you think a manatee's a hot lady with a fish bottom, but as a former sailor.
Many ships had daily rum rations too.
That's right. As a sailor, I know from my personal several weeks before that starts to look great. it's a strange world. So, did you actually watch the documentary or mockumentary? I don't even want to give it the credit of calling it a documentary. So,
yeah, I've not seen it in its entirety. I've seen bits and pieces and YouTube clips, but never seen the whole thing.
Gotcha.
You couldn't sit through it.
No, I did. I just decided not to torture myself like that.
Fair enough. We're just wondering if there was any science in the mockumentary at all, if they got anything right, or if it was just all fabricated.
You know, I mean, this is hearsay again because I haven't seen it, but I mean, I know a few people who work on sharks said that, you know, like, yeah, some of the basic ideas about Megalodon are okay. I mean, I think the problem is that no matter what truth they told in their discussion of Megalodon, the thing that people remember the most and have latched onto is that Megalodon still exists. And yes. So no matter what good information they give, it gets shrouded in all of this, all of these lies, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. Sure. They're polluting the pool of information.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, in doing a great disjustice.
I think you've covered one of our questions, which is, could they live today? I guess if they couldn't technically, because they'd have to have parents. And if there aren't any parents.
Well, that's a good first step. I mean, I could envision some sort of Jurassic Park scenario where, you know, some DNA extraction or I don't know.
It'd be tough. But yeah. But the world's changed, I guess. And so.
There's a lot of different species in the ocean. So, you know, would they still be able to compete? Would there be enough prey, enough? You know, there's still this idea that, like, it's really hard to support a carnivore that size. You know, so there's a reason why, you know, carnivorous whales, like sperm whale, the sperm whale, which is the largest of the toothed whales, is substantially smaller than the largest of the baleen whales. When you're that size, it's hard enough to find enough food for you to be able to consume efficiently, you know. And I mean, of course, one of the way the baleen whales do it is they, you know, they feed on these krill rich patches, you know, so they don't have to search for food. It's just basically, you know, they swim through a soup of it.
Yeah. Everyone's dream.
Me.
Yeah.
Have you seen the previews for this new action movie, The Meg?
Oh, I'm so excited about it.
Really? Okay.
I mean, because it's clearly fiction, right?
It does appear to be fiction, yes.
Yeah, it's not counted as a documentary. No, I think it looks, you know, I'm always up for a good, you know, a sort of monster or, you know, a monster flick or a good, you know, the world is ending flick, you know, or Armageddon or something.
Oh, yeah. My son loves the destruction flick. It doesn't really matter whether there's any science in it.
Whether it's geologic or biologic, I'm just as long as there's some explosions.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm right there with them. I don't want to act like I'm not. I mean, I'm sitting there eating the popcorn right next to them. So, yeah. So.
So can we ask you about modern sharks? Are they in any danger of extinction at all?
Well, absolutely. I mean, most, you know, quite a few, if not most of the shark species are, you know, are either threatened or near extinction. You know, and that's both from commercial fishing for sharks to shark finning to habitat degradation, you know, from pollution to overfishing of shark prey to warming oceans. I mean, you name it, the sort of stresses that and damage that humans have caused the ocean have sort of hit sharks from multiple sides. And so, you know, and these top predators, whether it be sharks or whether it be top predators, you know, like lions and tigers, you know, are always probably one of the most at risk groups.
And speaking of soup as well, aren't they? They're often caught to make shark fin soup.
Yeah, in some countries, you know, it's considered a delicacy. But my understanding of that whole process is that at the end, it doesn't taste much like a shark anyway. So
stone soup, yeah.
Yeah, it's stone soup.
Yeah, you mentioned lion sharks and tiger sharks, but there's no bear sharks though, right? why is that?
Yeah,
that seems like a hole.
Good question.
It's a real flaw in the system.
Well, maybe they are. Maybe they're hanging around in the same part of the ocean where megalodons. Maybe
that's probably what's happening.
I
predicted the Oz zone. We'll hear more about that later. So do you want to talk about your current research at all? Like, what are you working on these days?
So a lot of my work now focuses on not so much body size. You know, you sort of, every researcher goes through these shifts in their research. So a lot of my work looks at trying to understand the biodiversity of the deep oceans that occurs on the seafloor, and why some regions of the deep oceans have lots of species and other regions have fewer species, and why in general most of the deep sea, despite, you know, not having the food available to it or the complexity of a coral reef or a tropical rainforest, seemingly has, you know, lots and lots and lots of species, you know, on par with a coral reef or a tropical rainforest. So a lot of what my lab is doing is working on that kind of big question. Some of my group is working as well on, including myself, works on looking at how changes in the climate. When we think about climate change, we think about temperature, we think about parts of the ocean going anoxic or hypoxic, so lacking oxygen, or acidifying or becoming polluted or overfished. But one of the things that happens through all of this is that we change the way that the oceans produce carbon and produce food. And in fact, in most of the oceans, we're starting to see a decline in the overall productivity of the oceans. And so, or the overall amount of food that's available to the animals that live in that area. And so one of the things that my group studies is what is the consequences, especially for marine invertebrates, of this sort of food limitation.
Wow. So that sounds like a big data question. Are you like collecting samples? Yeah.
So the kinds of work that we do in the lab go from sort of big data, you know, big data initiatives, things that look sort of more like a bunch of geeks sitting around computers typing stuff in, to, you know, a lot of the deep sea work we do is at sea. So we'll spend a couple of weeks at sea with remote operated vehicles, you know, doing experiments or collecting samples. You know, we have an ongoing funded project that is looking at the continued impacts of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill on the deep oceans of the Gulf of Mexico. Well, and then, you know, I'm always looped back into body size stuff. So just last week I was at a conference and this group of scientists had sort of stumbled upon a relationship between what you feed on and how you feed and body size. And the group saw me at the conference like, hey, Craig studies body size. He'll know about this. And so I got sort of brought into this group project, if you will, to sort of try to figure out if this is a general pattern and if it applies equally to things like mammals and birds as well as snails. So despite, you know, it's one of those things I don't think I'll never leave the body size research alone, simply because people keep bringing me new, interesting questions.
Yeah, but I love that kind of collaboration. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah, I do too. Mm-hmm.
So I was curious, from a data collection perspective, I mean, the ocean changes all the time. So how do you collect data about these data points about the oxygen levels, the types of food that are there, the acidity, all that stuff, over a period of time? I mean, it seems like if you're in deep water, collecting that data at the exact same spot has to be really difficult.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we get snapshots and we try to get as many snapshots as we possibly can of the conditions at that moment. But, you know, like you said, you know, we're limited, you know, so we spent 2 weeks out in the Gulf of Mexico last year. We're not going out this year at all. And then we'll go out in 2019. So, you know, you're really uncovering some of the big sort of gaps of where our knowledge is.
I've just been so interested in like the idea of having some kind of aquatic drones that could dive deep, get samples, and then come back up and report, and then dive deep, like, but recharge, you know? And it's
there are some companies and some sort of oceanographic institutes that have been doing that, you know. So the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute has been doing that kind of work for, you know, probably a better part of a decade. But, you know, the tech still has kinks in it, and it's still very expensive.
Yeah, it's got to be massive. It's got to be inexpensive, and it's got to be safe for long-term use. There's a lot of problems, but I really want that to happen because there's so much data under there I want to know myself for a lot of reasons. So,
well, and there are still, I mean, there are also these sort of what's called an underwater observation network. And so Canada has this Neptune network that's off of their west coast. And so, you know, in which they have like multiple sites that are all cabled with power and Ethernet.
Ooh.
And so you can sit on shore and like look at cameras at the sites and look at your experiments that are going on and, you know, continuously get environmental data.
So cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all right, very, all right. Very cool project. And
I will talk your ear off. I got to stop. So.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if Craig knows that your alter ego is Dr. Atlantis.
Yeah. I'm very interested in this stuff. This is great. So thank you for what you do.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, Craig, we've just got one final question that we like to ask all of our guests, and that is, what's your favorite monster?
My favorite monster? Oh, man, I got to go. Oh, man, I have to pick just one, huh?
Well, that's the idea.
I guess. I mean, it's probably a bit predictable given what I do, and but I got to go with the Kraken.
Ooh, that's good.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Yeah. You know, with just an obscenely large squid. Yeah.
I've actually got a bet going right now with a squid guy, or well, a guy who studies.
That's a strange statement.
Well, we talked to him about sea monsters and the sort of the metrics of these things, and we bet a bottle of Kraken rum about whether or not a giant squid of a certain size would be found. So there's a bottle of rum. I'm hoping that it is found. I don't mind paying for the rum. So it's good. I want there to be huge, huge squid down there. So.
Yeah, there's probably not. I think we've capped up the upper limit of giant squids.
Well, if I get the rum, that's okay too.
I wanted to say to Craig as well, if you have an interest in big things. So I'm in Colorado at the moment, but I'm, as you can tell, from Australia originally. And an area that I used to live in for a while, Armadale, there's a town nearby called Tamworth, and there's an enormous golden guitar there that you should see. It's Tamworth is kind of the country music capital of Australia, so kind of like Nashville for Australia, but it is a massive guitar, so that's worth seeing.
Yeah, they have this, there's this app for your phone called Roadside America.
Uh-huh.
And it sort of brings up all these kind of weird attractions, and every time I go somewhere, I bring up that app to see if there's anything big in my vicinity that I can go take a picture with. So
that's great. Yeah, we have a giant peach and a giant peanut, and yeah.
Giant peach.
Not the one with James and giant peach. It's a different one.
No, not that one. Not to be confused with that.
We have a giant rocket chair too. Yeah,
there's a little town in. I'm sorry.
No, it's just because they had a giant rocket chair. You mentioned giant rocket chair. There was one of those up north of me, and I got all my kids sitting in it, and they were yelling, rock me, and I said, only if you call me Amadeus. And my wife...
It was lost on them.
It was completely lost on them, but my wife broke up. It was great. Not she didn't break up with me, well, least, which would probably be the right response. But anyway, it's not important.
I mean, still interesting, though. I mean, these big sculptures, I mean, why? Why do people do this?
Because it's not there.
So. Because
yeah, good point.
Because not everybody, I don't know. I guess there's just a lot of people like me, and everyone has a different outlet for this obsession. Well, you know, I turned into a research program, and some people build, you know, giant frying pans or giant balls of yarn.
But also, you can't see the world's smallest guitar from the road. So.
No, I haven't done. I don't know why I'm only fascinated with the biggest ones as opposed to the smallest things.
That's right. Yeah. I don't know. I like those roadside attractions and the Guinness Book of World Records and the Ripley's Believe It or Not. You know, with the entire Bible written on the back of a postage stamp and all this stuff. So yeah.
Yeah, no, I was a kid. They used to, Guinness the Guinness Book of Records used to come like as a paperback book every year.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would obsess over that. Like just every page I would read. I'm probably the only apparently I was a very nerdy kid too. And so
I think you're talking, a lot of our listeners are right here with you. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure.
I guess. And so the best thing happened to me, like probably about a month or so ago, I with a handful of other people, including, I was speaking about Alistair Dove at the Georgia Aquarium and a few of a group of students at Duke when I was still there. We published this paper called Sizing Ocean Giants. And we went through just a little less than 30 species in the ocean that were the biggest of the group. So what is the biggest, what is the biggest whale? How big does it get? What's the biggest shark? How big does the giant squid get? How big? And we tried for each one of these to collect all the known size data. And this includes things like giant clams and giant isopods. And we really did a bit of historical digging. So when we found out, the best example I can give is of the Australian trumpet snail, which is this massive, snail. It's huge. It's about 3 feet in size or so.
I never saw one of those.
Yeah, they're and the shells are gorgeous. And so we had a record estimate, but it wasn't. And then the same specimen was reported to have another length, and we tracked down the specimen to a museum in Houston and had somebody there measure it for us so we could confirm the length. And so we really poured a lot of time and effort into this. Anyway, so. And all of this paper is actually publicly available, and all of the data and stuff like that. We wanted to make it very open access to everybody. And so about a month ago, Guinness reached out to me and asked me a couple of questions about the paper and said that they were using my paper for a lot of their records and statistics because it was the best vetted data that they could find.
Nice.
And I was like, I had a total geek moment.
I was like,
oh my God, like, I'm the guy behind Guinness now, And, I sort of invited myself to their headquarters in London, but I don't know what I'm even expecting. It's probably just like an office building with normal offices. But for some reason, I'm expecting to see like exhibits of, here, not only do we collect records, but here are the largest things in the world and we have a vault of them.
Well, at least you should be able to get a drink, right? So,
but I remembered one other giant object in Australia, and in another rural town that's near Tamworth too. The town's called Gyra, and it's a giant sheep. And every year they have a lamb and potato festival around this sheep.
Wow,
that is fantastic!
What's it made of?
But I think it's just a big concrete. Sheep, but I think what's interesting about it is that Gyra, Blake, you might have heard of Gyra before.
I've heard of the poltergeist, right? The Gyra ghost.
Infamous for the Gyra ghost. A poltergeist from the 1920s. So yeah, they've not only got the Gyra ghost, but they've got a giant sheep.
That is cool.
Well, I think that sounds like more than enough to just sort of launch a trip.
For the 1,000 people living there, yeah.
Well, just for the sheer pleasure.
Oh,
wow. Beautiful. I think it's a good time to end it.
Yeah, probably. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Craig. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Craig. That was great.
Oh, thank you so much. I really thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Craig McLean about the prehistoric monster shark known as Megalodon. Links to Craig's work and many other items of interest will be at the show notes at monstertalk.org. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed here are those of myself and my guests and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. If you'd like to know their views, you can get into a submersible deep-sea vehicle and slowly descend into the darkest depths of the Marianas Trench, where a single flaw in your ship's structure could cause an implosion that would flash burn you to cinders as the air compressed around you, before then leaving your wet, ashy remains lost in the cold depths where sunlight cannot even penetrate. You know what? It would be easier just to go to skeptic.com and subscribe there. You can get the paper version or the digital version of the magazine. I mean, if you don't want any adventure in your life. Hey, say, if you're in New York City, don't forget that the New England Conference on Science and Skepticism is coming up. Nexus will be July 12th through 15th, featuring James Randi, George Schwab, Steve Novella, Natalia Reagan, and lots of other folks who I've worked with, admired, or work with and admired at the same time for years. So check it out at nexus.org. That's NECSS.org. If you're going to be in Frankfort, Kentucky this September, you can catch me speaking at the second annual CryptidCon on the weekend of September 9th and 10th. This will be at the Capitol Plaza Hotel in Frankfort, and you can get tickets at CryptidCon.com. They've got quite a lineup of cryptozoology and UFO guests this year, including Cliff and Bobo from Finding Bigfoot, Linda Godfrey of Dogman fame, Bob Gimlin, one half of the Patterson-Gimlin film team, Seth Breedlove of Small Town Monsters, and many more. And of course, me, Blake Smith, host of Monster Talk, where I'll be talking about the Kelly Hopkinsville Kentucky Goblins, right there in Kentucky. I hope to see you there. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms.
Save the date for a colossal PsyCon 2018. Bigger venue, bigger stars, bigger ideas, bigger fun. Las Vegas, October the 18th to the 21st, 2018. PsyCon is already one of the planet's premier skeptical conferences, where hundreds of critical thinkers come to Las Vegas, the city of illusions, to hear from the leading lights of science and skepticism. For 2018, we want PsyCon to be bigger than ever. We've even booked a bigger hotel. Come to Las Vegas at the Westgate Resort and Casino to see the brilliant and hilarious Stephen Fry on stage with Richard Dawkins. An opening night talk by Steven Pinker on the ideas behind his new book, Enlightenment Now. The triumphant return of James the Amazing Randi. Plus, New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer, psychologist and memetics expert Susan Blackmore, the Psy Babe Yvette D'Entremont, virologist and advocate for science-based medicine Paul Offit, and many, many more, along with comic musician George Rubb, serving as Master of Ceremonies, a magic show from Banachek, author book signings, and of course, a Halloween costume party. It's true. Conspiracy theorists, quacks peddling fake medicine, and the deniers of evolution, climate change, and vaccine science are bigger threats than ever. With PsyCon 2018, let's show them that they have just met their match. We'll see you in Las Vegas. For more information and to book your tickets, visit csiconference.org. That's psiconference.org.
Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Hungry for more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
You're going to need a bigger boat.